Are continuing through our series looking at the first letter of the Apostle Peter to various churches scattered throughout what is modern day Turkey. And I think we probably live in an age which finds listening carefully quite hard. We're used to just having a kind of quick tweet or X or whatever it's called these days, and we kind of instantly react to it and flavour it with whatever we think the person might be saying rather than what they are saying. And well-meaning people say something in public or online. Many hear what they want to hear, and they quickly get up in arms without listening to what they're really saying. And the temptation, I think, would be to do that very thing with our reading this morning. Those first words from Peter might have really jarred with you. Slaves, submit to your masters. That could easily cause us, I think, to go straight into outrage mode. Oh, I see, right, yeah, I get it. The Bible approves of slavery. I knew it. It's a bigoted, imperialistic, irrelevant book, etc., etc. But before we go there, let's think about what's really going on here. What's Peter really saying? Well, earlier on in chapter 2, he said this, submit yourselves, he's speaking to the Christians in Asia Minor, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every authority instituted among men. Peter recognises that the world around him contains certain institutions. And the first he mentions in that passage is the Roman Empire. Now, when he calls on Christians to submit to the emperor, there is no way he could have been approving of the Roman Empire with its brutal occupation of his homeland, its killing of other Christians. Peter's point in calling on Christians to submit to this institution is not to approve of the Roman Empire, but to call on Christians to avoid the temptation to be violent revolutionaries, to want to overthrow those masters, as many in Judea were planning to do, which, as you know your history, they did eventually do, with very, very sad consequences. In the same way, when he calls upon slaves to obey their masters, he is not approving of and recommending the institution of slavery any more than he is the brutal pagan Roman Empire. Both of these are things he calls instituted among men. In other words, temporary states of affairs put in place by humans. And Peter will go on to make it abundantly clear why Christians are to have that attitude, both to the emperor and to slave masters, and we'll see that in a mo. Part of what it means to be a Christian is to obey God. And Jesus taught us how we should live. It's a radical message of turning the other cheek and of forgiving those who harm us. And the Apostle Peter recognises that for many, this forgiveness will cause suffering. As Christians suffer at the hands of harsh rulers and harsh masters while not retaliating. In all this, says Peter, our example is Jesus Christ. He said in our passage, when they hurled insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. He committed no wrong and was only ever loving and compassionate towards others. And yet Peter is referring to the point here when Jesus was hanging in agony on the cross. And rather than feeling sorry for him, people hurled insults at him. And Peter says, he committed no sin and no deceit was found in his mouth. In other words, he didn't revile those who were reviling him. And so he left us an example in leaving the judging of their evil to the last day when God will right all wrongs and in not taking upon himself to retaliate. Because he is God himself. Jesus could easily have said, Father, zap them with a bolt of lightning for insulting me, or may the ground open up and swallow them. But no, he said rather, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So such radical obedience to God in forgiveness, in turning the other cheek, is impossible, humanly speaking. And I think probably each one of us in our lives have come across times when we've wanted to respond against those who have hurt us, or those who have hurted people that we loved, with wanting to pay them back, with wanting to hurt them in the way that they've hurt us. Each one of us has felt that. It's not possible for us to live the life that Jesus has called us to without his help. And that's why, at the end of our passage, Peter tells us the only way that such obedience is possible. And the problem is that in our natural state, we can't help but want revenge. But that desire is part, actually, of the malfunction in our thoughts and in our desires that the Bible calls sin. Because sin is not primarily sins. Sin is not primarily the bad things we do. The bad things are a result of the primary problem, which is misdirected desire. Because the Bible tells us that we were designed to desire God first, to desire the good of others next, and to desire our own good last. But the Bible also tells us that those things have been flipped around because of sin, so that we desire our own good first, then begrudgingly desire the good of others, and then completely forget about the desiring God. We put ourselves in his place and make ourselves the judges of right and wrong, of true and false. And although we find it hard to really understand and feel the impact of it, the Bible tells us that this putting of ourselves in God's place constitutes a terrible act of rebellion against the one who gave us life and who has only ever loved us and sought our good. And that's why the eternally loving and good God has provided a solution. When Jesus died on the cross, he bore in himself the judgment against human rebellion and sin, so that humans need not ever bear that judgment themselves. He destroys sin by taking it upon himself and defeating it, as Peter made abundantly clear in our reading. He says, quoting Isaiah 53, "By his wounds you have been healed." And Jesus' death in our place, that we celebrate every time we take communion, not only deals with the penalty for our sin, it also deals with the power of our sin. In other words, its power to cause our desires to malfunction. We can then begin to live as we were always intended to, putting God first, others second, and ourselves last. I always ask couples preparing to have their children baptized the question, what do you think it means in the baptism liturgy where you say that you will promise to help your children to walk in the way of Christ? And most people say, well, walking in the way of Christ means to be a jolly good person. And that's true, but it's the second part of the answer to that question. What does it mean to walk in the way of Christ? Yes, Jesus does want you to be a good person. But there's a first part to that answer that people always miss out. That's like saying the answer to 12 plus 12 is T4. Do you get it? You're missing out the crucial bit at the beginning, which helps it make sense. It's 24, isn't it? Just saying T4 doesn't really answer the question. Until Jesus has dealt with the malfunction of sin within our hearts and in our minds, we simply cannot be a good person as God intended us to be. The motivation to obedience to God's instructions, whether we're a subject of the Roman Empire, whether we're a slave under a harsh master, or whether we're a Christian here in the 21st century, the motivation is always the same. We look to the cross. We recognize that Jesus died in our place because we were under God's judgment for our rebellion against him. But we rejoice that Jesus died in our place so that we can enter into a relationship with the God who made us and who loves us infinitely. And we can begin to realign our desires, our thoughts and our priorities with his. And so one final thought. St. Peter and Jesus himself taught that we should suffer for doing good rather than retaliate. But I don't think this means that Christians should refrain from changing those human institutions which we talked about earlier. Christians are never in a place where they can kill the emperor or kill their masters. But humans instituted the Roman Empire. Humans instituted slavery. So humans can change or abolish them, especially when, like slavery, they are harmful. But Christians should refrain from the kind of change which involves retaliation and revenge. Every revolution, whether it was in France or in Russia or in China, has involved 5% justice and 95% revenge. So as Christians, we are to allow Jesus' death to cleanse us, to change us, And we're to be neither those who are so conservative that we see every institution as unchallengeable, nor those who are so radical that lives end up being ruined or lost in the cause of revolution. So let's pray that God would help us to live this out in our lives.